Our guest speaker this morning will be Paula Perlman, who is the Executive Director of the Disability Rights Legal Center, a cross-disability civil rights organization that champions social justice through advocacy, education, and litigation. She has had a distinguished career of over 30 years in public interest, law and class action litigation in the areas of disability rights, sex discrimination, and immigration law. She is also a visiting associate professor of law at Loyola Law School, Los Angeles. In 2010, she received St. Ignatius of Loyola Award as being a person for others. Ms. Perlman will be speaking on stigmatizing people with mental illness, the real evil. The causes, as well as our social responsibilities for the recent mass killings in Connecticut and Colorado, have been complex. The media latches on to mental illness as a cause of such large-scale evil. Yet, current understandings of mental illness evidence that we cannot justify denying rights and freedoms to ever larger classes of people. There are no easy solutions. This talk will explore and help clarify the moral and practical issues that we have to weigh in our understanding of such horrific events. It is my pleasure to welcome Paula Perlman.
Thank you for welcoming into your congregation this morning. I really appreciate it. I wanted to thank Jim Gardner for finding me. It started with a letter to the editor from the legal director at the Disability Rights Legal Center, Michelle Uzzetta, after the shooting in Newtown. Her letter stated, "In the wake of unspeakable tragedies like the Connecticut shooting, the tendency in our society is to label what happened, pack it in a box, and tuck it away somewhere. It's our collective defense mechanism. More often than not, the conversation quickly and unfairly turns to disability. These conversations usually lack depth and understanding, and they do nothing more than promote inaccurate, unfair stereotypes. Some reports suggested that the Connecticut shooter had a form of autism. There's no more a correlation between autism and violence than there is between playing the piano and violence. As President Obama said, now is the time for meaningful action. Let's look beyond superficial explanations and conduct a deeper analysis of the true culprits behind this tragedy, American gun culture, and the understanding of social services to help those in crisis, regardless of disability status." So Jim read that in the paper and tracked Michelle down, and Michelle said, "Paula, this is yours." And so here I am. Thank you. So December 14th, 2012, Newtown, Connecticut, the shooter, Adam Lanza, 20, ammo magazine capacity, 30 rounds. Shots fired, unknown. Killed, 27, plus the shooter, 28. Wounded, unknown. Outcome, suicide. August 5th, 2012, Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Shooter, Wade Michael Page, 40, age 40. Ammo capacity, magazine capacity, 19 rounds. Shots fired, unknown. Killed, 6, plus shooter, 7. Total 7, wounded, 3. July 20th, 2012, The Dark Knight Rises, movie theater shooting. Aurora, Colorado, shooter, James Holm, 24. Ammo magazine capacity, 100 rounds. Shots fired, more than 70. Killed, 12. Wounded, 58. He's waiting trial. Carson City IHOP, September 6, 2011. Carson City, Nevada, shooter, Eduardo Sencion, age 32, ammo magazine capacity, 30 rounds, shots fired, unknown, killed, 4, plus shooter, 5, wounded, 7, outcome, suicide. July 7th, 2011, Grand Rapids, Michigan, shooter, Roderick Shante Dantzler, age 34, ammo magazine capacity, 30 rounds. Shots fired, more than 10. Killed, 7, plus shooter, 8. Wounded, 2. Outcome, suicide. January 8, 2011, U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords, Congress on your corner, Tucson, Arizona. Shooter, Jared Lee Loughner, age 22. Ammo magazine capacity, 33 rounds and 15 rounds. Shots fired, 33. Killed, 6. Wounded, 13. Waiting trial. August 3, 2010. Hartford beer distributor, Manchester, Connecticut. Shooter, Omar Thornton, age 34. Ammo magazine capacity, 17 rounds. Shots fired, 11. More than 11. Killed, 8. Plus shooter. Wounded, 2. Outcome, suicide. Need I go on? There are more. I have 12 pages of this. These are mass shooting incidents in America from 1984 to 2012. So Newton, Connecticut is just one of many across the country that we have to grapple with. And I was so happy when the kids left. I was like, oh, I can't do this in front of them. So I was relieved that they left, because I don't think that they need to be exposed to this any more than they're already exposed to it by us having the radio on and the TV on and driving in the car and looking at, you know, reading the paper and the cover pictures of newspapers. So, but I'm not hopeless, and I don't feel paralyzed. And I think that's my message today. We're not without hope, and we're not paralyzed. And that, if anything, we're compelled to action. I do the work that I do. I run a disability rights legal center. It's a cross-disability organization. So we're dealing with legal issues related to cancer, to physical disabilities, to physical accessibility, to sensory disabilities, to special education services, to mental health issues. We're looking at society as a whole. The reading this morning was so appropriate about systemic change. I just don't want to fix one thing for one person. I want that one person to identify a problem, and I want to marshal the resources to address that problem. And this is one of those things, and we're at this amazing crossroads of opportunity to deal with these things. And it's not just... and it's not just one size fits all. There will be multiple levels of solutions that we need to, and energy and efforts that we need to bring to bear to this problem. Because this is a problem. And it's an opportunity to do something. As there was a recent testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights in February. And it was proposals to address gun violence, protecting our communities while respecting the Second Amendment. So no one here is suggesting that the Second Amendment is going to go away. And in fact, there's been recent decisions. It's called Heller versus District of Columbia decision. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case that the District of Columbia, well, it's actually from 2008 Supreme Court ruling, but the District of Columbia outlawed all assault weapons, outlawed all weapons. And the Supreme Court said, you know what, that went too far. It went way too far. And in fact, the Supreme Court established a principle that people had held true, but there was no legal ruling on it, that you did have the right to bear arms for self-defense in your own home. So people have been saying, oh, I have this right, I have this right, I have this right. Now we have a Supreme Court decision that that protects that right to bear arms, not just in a militia to prevent the government from having too much power, but you have the right to bear arms in your own home. That being said, the decision said also that the Second Amendment right is not unlimited, that there are types of regulations under the Second Amendment that can limit gun ownership by felons and the mentally ill, and also you can regulate dangerous and unusual weapons. And so we have this opportunity to address issues related to gun control and reasonable regulations under the Second Amendment that the U.S. Supreme Court said we could regulate versus addressing people with mental health issues and addressing the access to services with respect to mental health services that are not necessarily available in the community for people with mental illness. So I think this is, for me, I think it's interesting because we're hearing one very extreme side, no regulation, I have a Second Amendment right, versus no, you don't have that, you may have that right, but it doesn't go that far. And there's actually this middle ground that says, okay, you do have that right, and that right is subject to rational regulation. And now the conversation is, what is that rational regulation that's constitutionally protected? Now, that's the conversation. If we can get the extreme right and the extreme left to, you know, come closer to the middle, I think we have this in society in general right now. You know, we're in a very polarized time. But now that the Supreme Court has really made clear that this is the law and you have a right to do something about it, then what are we going to do about it? We have, and I'll talk more about proposals about regulation that's pending, and I'll talk more about California law, and I'll talk more about people with mental health conditions and what we can do about that as well. You with me? Okay. I'm used to teaching, so I want like feedback. Not just, really, I'm going to talk this whole time. So, yes, I am. I have a lot to say, but I want also to... it's been a really interesting process to learn about this and to develop, like, a voice, for me to develop a voice on this. Because, you know, I'm a mother. I have two children. I want them to be safe. They live in New York City. I want them to be safe. I work with people all the time who are stigmatized, who do have severe mental illness, and who are stigmatized, and who people treat as other and people are afraid of. And so I don't want every time you see the person who may be experiencing homelessness on the street and they're talking and they're not talking on their cell phone like the rest of us are, because you can never tell anymore, right? People are walking down the street and you think, who are they talking to or about or with? And you realize they're on their phone. But we can't, fear can't govern all that we do. As a society, fear can't govern all that we do. So we have this U.S. Supreme Court decision, and then coming out of that, there's been a very robust discussion about what can we do, what is appropriate gun legislation. So one of the things that's coming out of nationally is limiting the size of large capacity ammunition magazines. So there's little clips that hold 10 bullets, and there's magazines that hold 30 or more, or even up to 100 rounds. 100 rounds. And so what we've learned is the more ammunition you have, the more lethal is the shooting. And that Gabby Giffords, one of the reasons that there were not as many people killed during that shooting in Arizona was that he had to reload, his magazine capacity was limited. And during this period of time when he was shifting guns, somebody could tackle him. So it gave an opportunity for intervention. So one proposal is to limit the size of ammunition magazines, which is You know, restricting an average citizen's ability to load more than 10 bullets at a time is generally considered common sense. Law enforcement supports it because it gives them an opportunity to intervene as well. If you're using hunting, you know, for hunting and sport, usually you use one at a time. You don't need, you know, that's the whole skill of sport hunting. You know, you're aiming, you're shooting, you're not just, you know, you want something left of the animal when you shoot it, right? And that it does really reduce the mass fatalities when you limit them. According to the FBI, you know, 6.8% of crimes committed with firearms, of all the crimes in the United States, 68% are committed with firearms. In New York City, it's 60%. Of robberies, murders, 68%, robberies are 36%, and aggravated assault are 19%. People say, well, I need it in my home. Actually, there's all this new research that shows, like, if there is an intruder in your home, usually it's unusual that you will actually have access to a gun and use it in time, and that you don't, the shootings that have happened have been used with one or two shots, and you haven't needed these large magazines. And according to constitutional scholars, their analysis of this Heller decision would show that restricting large capacity ammunition magazines would not be constitutionally, would not violate the Second Amendment. So that's one very, you know, straightforward, simple thing that we can do nationally, and that would help eliminate the fatalities in the event that these shootings happen again. The other thing that we can do is we can start with this interstate strike force on illegal guns. The top sources of firearms recovered in the East Coast are from Virginia and Florida, Georgia, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. They travel across the southern part of the United States. And California is a big supplier of guns as well. And so that there can be regional answers as, that we can address. We can also micro-stamp a bullet, because then you can show where the person, sometimes that's the only evidence left in a crime scene, is the actual bullet casing. So there's a move afoot to micro-stamp them, so that you can say, you can find out, you can trace the origins of the ammunition. So you can figure out where did the firearm come from. And that way you can find out about gun show purchasers and illegal gun transfers. If somebody had a gun and they bought it for somebody who is not entitled to have a gun, that you can, that there's greater opportunity to fix the problem. So these are just like a few simple things. Also, one of the constitutional principles that permit you to have rational regulation of guns are dangerousness, commonness of use, and connection to core self-defense interests. So if you can demonstrate that the Second Amendment doesn't provide legal shelter to the features that trigger a firearms prohibition under the ban. So if it doesn't deal with those issues, then you can make choices. So one of the things that there's a move now to ban assault weapons, because they're built, the most important component of these newly proposed assault weapons ban is the prohibition on the high capacity magazines. So, and also there's, it's interesting because there's research that says that you just because you're entitled to own a weapon doesn't mean you're entitled to have weapons that are the same as the military. Like, it's not the same. You know, your need for self-defense is not the same as the military in, you know, fighting a war. And that the military characteristics can be constitutionally correct. I can't think of the word. I'm really sorry. That time change really is not, I'm not ready yet. I wasn't. It was like, what? And I had already changed the time in my car, so I couldn't even commiserate, going, wait, it really is only 8 o'clock. It was like, no, it says 9 o'clock. It's 9 o'clock. So there's a lot about guns. There's a some really good websites I can email you, but one is called the Citizens Crime Commission it's called nycrimecommission.org is its site, the Citizens Crime Commission of New York City, and that details all the shootings. It also has some of the proposals. Lawrence Tribe, if you Google proposals to reduce gun violence, you know, on Google, you'll get many, many things, but if you do, Lawrence Tribe, or you do the subcommittee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, you'll get some written testimony that's really useful and interesting to read. The PBS just did a survey that said even NRA members support certain gun control policies. So this was through John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and they posed 31 hypothetical gun control policies to adults across political and gun ownership. 87% support requiring a background check system for all gun sales to make sure a purchaser is not legally prohibited from having a gun. 87%. 85% requiring states to report a person to the background check system who's prohibited from buying a gun, either due to involuntary commitment to a hospital for a psychiatric treatment or to being declared mentally incompetent by a court of law. So in California, we already have those things, so we're ahead of the nation. 85% prohibiting a person on the terror watch list from having a gun. And 82% support allowing the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to temporarily take away a gun dealer's license if an audit reveals record-keeping violations and a dealer cannot account for 20 or more of his or her guns. So these are just simple things. Like, here's the law. You didn't follow the law. You don't get to own a gun. It doesn't interfere with anybody's right to own a gun if they don't fall within those areas. And then 81% prohibit a person convicted of a serious crime as a juvenile from having a gun. And so for 10 years, I mean, to me, I think that we have so much long-term sentencing for youth anyways that most of these, I mean, we're treating juveniles as adults right now. We have over 300 people in California state prisons who are sentenced to life without possibility of parole already, who are young people committing crimes. And there was just a law passed last year that says they're actually, after 25 years in prison, they can be resentenced. They have an opportunity to go before a judge to be resentenced. So these are 14, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds who committed a crime and been charged as adults who are serving time in prison. They have multiple life sentences. It's essentially a death sentence for most of them. But it was called SB9 in California. Senator Yee passed it, championed this. It was through a Fair Sentencing for Youth campaign. So these are all, like, things that we can do. So gun laws matter. There's the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. It's another really good resource. It's called smartgunlaws.org. And it turns out that gun laws help. And California is, like, among the leader in the nation of having strong gun laws. Why do they help? They reduce deaths, essentially. Why does that matter? I think we want to reduce deaths in our society. And it means that we think about Newtown and we think about the Aurora Theater, but gun violence is happening every day on a very intimate, personal basis in people's homes. On the LA Times for LA County, the coroner gives them data on deaths. and it's current as of December 31st. But you look at them, and there are people who are sitting on their porch, and there's a drive-by shooting. There's somebody, who's experiencing domestic violence, and they're shot by their partner. There's less traumatic things are happening in our society that really we need to pay attention to as well. Where does this take us? It takes us to bringing mental illness out of the shadows. I was speaking with a friend of mine yesterday, and she said, isn't it a priori that if you're committing these despicable acts of gun violence, that you have a mental illness? Whether you've been in jail, whether you've been involuntarily detained, whether you've been in a psychiatric hospital, whether you've been being treated by a psychiatrist or any other healthcare professional. Isn't it like if you do something like this, you have a serious mental illness? And I think we can agree that that's what we think. And so, but we have to understand that the vast majority of Americans with a mental health condition are not violent. It's just 3-5% of violent crimes are committed by individuals who suffer from who really are experiencing serious mental illness. But what we know is that mental illness can develop into a crisis situation if they're left untreated, can lead to violence. My daughter's boyfriend's roommate committed suicide in September. He jumped off a roof. This is a 25-year-old young man with a graduate degree in engineering who had broken up with his girlfriend. She had broken up with him, and he made a bad decision at a bad moment. And he didn't take anybody else with him. But he made a bad decision in a bad moment, and nobody knew. He didn't tell his roommates. My daughter's a first-year medical student. He didn't tell her. He mentioned to his father that he was kind of down. He was kind of really sad that his girlfriend had broken up with him. And so, and he was a graduate student, so the school itself was devastated that they had a student who is currently enrolled, didn't avail themselves of student mental health services that are available. So I think that we have to talk about mental illness, and we have to make it less of a stigma. When I teach disability rights law, for most of my trainings, I'll do an exercise that it's called Pick a Disability. And I'll draw a chart, and it'll say a list of disabilities on one side, and then your most preferred and your least preferred on the other. So paraplegia, deafness, blindness, mental illness, epilepsy. And nobody wants mental illness. When people choose their least preferred, it's frequently the one that they're going to pick, because there's a stigma attached to it. They'll pick their most preferred as blindness because they know someone who's blind, or they'll pick deafness because they know somebody who's deaf, or they'll pick epilepsy because it's hidden and you can take medication, sort of like a temporary disability. But nobody picks mental illness. Nobody. Nobody says, I really admire Ellen Sachs. She's a law professor at USC, and she has a psychoanalytic. She has a joint appointment with the medical school and the law school, and she has schizophrenia. And she, is really brilliant and has schizophrenia. Nobody says, I want to be just like Ellen Sachs. But Ellen Sachs you know, is in psycho. She has a beautiful, beautiful biography. And she talks about the fact that she goes to therapy 4 times a week. She has medication. She has strong relationships with people who can tell her, Ellen, come back. You're going off track. She has work. And she's studying what it is about her and other very high-functioning people with schizophrenia. What is it about her that makes her be able to be so successful? But nobody says, I want to be just like Ellen. She, you know, have you watched Charlie Rose's Brain series? She was on that series. But we don't say, you know, schizophrenia, that's for me. Because we're terrified of it, and we're afraid that we're going to end up being the person who's experiencing homelessness on the street talking about it. And we don't want to be that person. So what do we do? I don't want to leave you with, oh great, so you have identified the problem, and now what are you going to do about it? So one of the things that we have to do is we have to talk about it. We have to say, we have to stop using the word crazy in our society. That drives me crazy. He's crazy. That's nuts. Those are all bad disability references. And so language really matters. I don't say he's homeless because that's not a permanent condition. It's not necessarily permanent. They're experiencing homelessness right now. That person has a mental illness. The situation is frustrating. It really frustrates me. It's not driving me nuts. It's just language that we choose. In the same way, we don't say, we don't usually call adult women girls, right? We took back some, now I have friends or younger women than me who say, I'm taking back the word, Paula. We're girls. It's like, no, you're 40. You can't be a girl. You can't work. Girl, there's child labor laws, you know, so you can't do it. No, you're a woman. You can be a young woman. You can be a younger woman. I have 2 young adult daughters. They're young women. And I can call them my girls, but I'm thinking of them when they were 10 when I say that. So what do? We change our language, and we eliminate that because there's lots of stigma. And when someone says to you, you know, I'm really depressed, we say, do you want to talk about it? We don't say, oh, you know, I've got to go do my shopping. I'm really sorry, but I have this thing that's due tomorrow. Oh, I promised my mom I'd pick her up, take her to lunch. So you say, if I can't talk about it now, let's figure out a time to talk about it. President Obama just proposed in Now is the Time, the President's plan to protect our children and our communities by reducing gun violence. It's also, you know, closing the background check loopholes to keep guns out of dangerous hands, banning military-style assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and taking other common-sense steps to reduce gun violence, making schools safer, and to me that does not mean arming teachers, and increasing access to mental health services. So what should we do with mental health services? Well, under Medicaid, you can expand mental health funding. To be part of the Medicaid expansion. So we should be ensuring that in our healthcare exchange that mental health services are covered. We have to assume that you have to know that adults with any mental illness who received treatment in the past 20 years by race and ethnicity is not the same for people of color as it is for whites. Asians, black, Hispanics receive less mental health treatment than whites do, significantly less than all adults. There's no relationship between the availability of psychiatric hospital beds and murders involving firearms and incarceration rates. So every time someone says you need a watch list of people who are receiving psychiatric treatment, there's no correlation between the receipt of psychiatric treatment and gun violence, or the availability of psychiatric beds and gun violence. Psychiatric meaning in hospitalization kinds of beds. So what we need is community mental health services. And we need to have a discussion about the fact that we're allowed to talk about these things without being stigmatized, without being afraid to lose our jobs. So the state of Missouri just introduced a bill that says Any member of the General Assembly, that's their legislation, who proposes a piece of legislation that further restricts the right of an individual to bear arms as set forth under the Second Amendment of the Constitution of the United States shall be guilty of a Class D felony. It's not a joke. So they did it. It's House Bill number 633. So we have to stop. I think when we see things like that, we have to say, no, no, it's okay. We have to be advocates for these things. So we can have background checks for gun sales. We can do all of those things. But what I want is, I want teachers to have training so that they can identify these young people who are socially isolated, who don't talk to anybody, and that they see that as something that deserves intervention, not just, they don't make noise, they're not bothering me, I don't have to do anything about it. That's simple. We're already every school has an obligation to identify a child with special need who may need special education services and, you know, specialized instruction and related services, including mental health services. Schools already have that obligation. So why don't we provide them with some additional training so that they see a child who, the Columbine shooters, where they see a child who, a student whose activities are not typical. They're not typical to be so socially isolated. That's not typical, to be not talking to anybody else, to not have a relationship with a teacher, to not have a relationship with your peers. That's not typical. That student who's not bothering anybody, that the teacher has a resource to a counselor, to an administrator, to somebody who says, you know what, James, come, I need you to come into the office and we're going to talk. And that you have some kind of assessment so that that student who is not causing trouble will not potentially cause trouble either. But also so that there's a way in which they can continue to develop and get treatment. We know so much about the brain now, and we're learning so much more, and so much more about its plasticity and ability to grow and learn and change. So we have these wonderful opportunities to intervene. So we want to make sure that students and young adults get treatment for their mental health issues. And there's so many people who come in contact with young people who don't recognize it as something. So the administration's launching a new project called Project AWARE, Advancing Wellness and Resilience in Education, to provide training and set up systems to provide referrals. And this means that there's sort of like a mental health first aid training for teachers so that they see something and they have an idea about. They may not know what to do themselves, but they'll have a resource to be able to go to and address that issue. And then to make students aware of the fact that their mental illness happens. You break your arm. You can be depressed. It's brain chemistry. So it happens. You're not bad because of it. But we're still so afraid to talk about it. We are. We're afraid we're not going to get hired. We're afraid. And that's what frightens me about some of these. We have to have an inventory. We have to keep a list of all the people who have ever received mental health treatment. Because then what you'll do is prevent people from seeking treatment. Because they don't want to be stigmatized. They don't want to be on a list. They don't want to apply for graduate school and not get in because, ooh, we don't want another shoot every year. Oh, we're not going to hire them. So we need to support individuals at these critical ages, this age 16 to 25. Though there was a shooter, remember there was a young man, I think it was, he shot his dad, and then he shot kids at school. He was just, he pled not guilty by reason of insanity. The judge didn't buy that. He was convicted and serving, I think it's like 7 life terms. So we need to help schools address pervasive violence. And we need to train more mental health professionals to serve students and young adults. We have a shortage of people. We need to train social workers and counselors, psychologists. Those are the people who have lost their jobs, right, at schools? My kids' high school, there's one counselor for every 900 students. That's not... I need to stop. I'm sorry. So... there are things that we can do. We can use health insurance, the Affordable Health Care Act. We can do things in school, and we can hear just what you're doing. You are at the vanguard of launching a national discussion to a conversation to increase understanding about mental health. So, thank you.